Welcome to the Crozier Vision podcast. In this recording, which took place on Thursday, 23rd of June, 2011, I chat with Paul Marks, who is probably best known for his long and wide-ranging posts for Samosata. How's the economy? How's the world economy?
Well, I've been surprised that unemployment hasn't gone up more in Britain. I think our wages have been more flexible than I thought they would be. And, of course, contrary to what is taught, flexible wages actually mean less unemployment, not more unemployment, because what they'll tell you is, oh, if wages go down, there's less demand, and then we all eat each other, which is just bilge. So actually the fall in wages has been the only, relative fall in wages, real fall in their purchasing power, has been the only thing which has kept us from having genuine mass unemployment.
Aren't wages a bit sticky? I mean, isn't what normally
yes,
happens a bit
they are a bit sticky. But I thought... Okay,
can I just explain...
I thought they would be even sticky. By sticky, of course, you mean the old point that wages are sticky downwards.
In that people will hold out for high salaries and would rather
It's not what they hold out for. It's that they're forbidden by various regulations from competing on price.
They are?
That's what I was just writing about. Because Natalie had written a little post about a Conservative Member of Parliament who suggested the disabled people should be allowed to compete on price, i.e. to prove themselves, to get into a job, they should be allowed to put in a bid for a wage that's below the minimum wage.
But, I mean, is that the only sort of state-sanctioned stickiness that we have?
The pro-union laws, the licensing laws, there's a million and one elements of stickiness. But the thing is, I was wrong, because I believed that wages would be more sticky than they have proved to be. Now, there was some genuine deregulation of the labour market in the latter years of Mrs. Thatcher's time, not in the early years. Jim Pryor was completely useless.
I seem to remember there were some councils, wages councils.
We had an absolutely terrible recession from 1979 to 1982. Mm-hmm. And real wages didn't fall at all. So you have a massive fall in output, worse than 29-32, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Real wages don't fall at all. So, of course, unemployment exploded. Unemployment more than doubled. And that was basically because wages in those days were incredibly inelastic.
Now, is that because of unions or wages?
It was only when Norman Tebbit replaced Jim Pryor as employment secretary that you got labour market reform. It's not the way that you or me would have done it. You know, we completely... What he did, in a way, was to add more regulations on the unions, but there was a precedent for it. Back in the 1930s, there was a thing passed in America called the Wagner Act, 1935, Wagner or Wagner, whatever you want to call it, which basically put unions above the law and allowed them to do all sorts of things like obstruct people's front gates and all the rest of it, and you couldn't get rid of them, whatever, even if you signed a contract and so on. Now, rather than repeal the Wagner Act, which soon became sacred and hallowed by academia and Hollywood and all the rest, what the Republicans did was pass an amending act, the Taft Act, Taft-Hartley, and they... So it basically said, well, you have to have ballots and you have to have internal union elections and so on and all the rest of it, which looks like it's adding more interventions, because it is, but those interventions have the effect of lessening the original intervention. And that's what, broadly speaking, what Tebbit did. Piling rules upon the unions, he weakened the powers they'd been given by previous government legislation. It's not the way that you or me would have done it. We would have repealed the existing regulations. What he did was impose more. Not in every respect. In some respect, regulations were repealed. But basically, the approach was a matter of trade union reform, weakening them that way. And of course they knew that, and they said that very loudly. But they couldn't say it too loudly, because the people would say, well, hang on, you're saying that democracy weakens you. Why would it do that? And so on and so forth. And one of the big arguments in America right now is over right-to-work states. And the National Labor Relations Board is desperate to prevent companies moving to right-to-work states. Now, what is a right-to-work state?
Is this the Boeing thing that's going on?
Yes, Boeing in South Carolina is a classic example of it. Because they were building a new factory in South Carolina, and people were saying, you're doing that because it's a right-to-work state, so you won't have to deal with the union.
You better explain what a...
The National Labor Relations Board said you're not going to be allowed to have the factory there unless you make it union.
Sorry, Paul. So a right-to-work state is a state that...
Now, that's what I was going to say. A right-to-work state is a state where the state legislature has taken advantage of the federal law, the Taft law, allowing them to say, people have a right to say no. Now, you might say, well, that's an intervention, which it is. It allows someone who goes to work to say, no, I don't want you to join the union.
Oh, they still have the closed
shop. And, of course, that has the effect, what you call the free rider problem. If one person can say, I don't have to join the union, lots of other people will also say they don't have to join the union, and the union can't make money in that plant because no one's going to join it, because they'd have to pay dues to join it. But if you get the same conditions, whether you're in the same pay and the same conditions, whether you're in the union or not, why should you pay then?
So how come the National Labor Relations Board, is that the one? How come that's involved? If there's a...
Because it made itself involved, because the acts of Congress are so vague, and they're basically enabling acts. And I did use that term deliberately, because the original Enabling Act was passed, not this one, but the original one was passed in 1933, at roughly the same time Hitler did his, which gives the executive the power to make law. The National Labor Relations Board, which was set up in the 1930s, as part of the Wagner Act, I believe, in 1935, basically can make lots of rules, which then add to the force of law. In Britain, they're called delegated legislation. So it says, well, hang on, we think by a 5-4 vote, because that's how the board works, we believe that you've done this to get round the unionization of your plants in Washington State. And Boeing jumps up and down and says, no, we haven't. No, those plants are going to stay open. This is a new one. Yes, honest. And we're not going to transfer work, even if we probably are. And so actually, of course, the left has a genuine case. And you can judge it either way. And the way these things are judged is arbitrarily and politically. Who appoints the people to the National Labor Relations
Board? Well, I suppose the question is, who's doing the judging?
Well, of course, the president appoints the people. The president presently is Barack.
But it's the NLRB. I mean, it's the National Labor Relations
Board.
They are judge and jury, effectively, on this one.
Well, yes. I mean, you can challenge them in court. I mean, one of the things they're now doing, their latest move, is to say a ballot for the unionization of a plant has to occur within 10 days of a union request. Now, think about that. A union can be campaigning to get people to sign up, because the majority have to sign up for a ballot. They could be doing that for 2 years. Then suddenly they produce the petition. You have the ballot within 10 days. The management has no time to organize a campaign, so it automatically loses. The old rule was 90 days. Just at a stroke, you could unionize vastly more plants. You must remember one of the deep upsettedness of the American left concerning the American worker. It goes back to the sociological studies called the so-called Middletown studies. And these were famous in the sort of verified world of sociology, because they showed American workers didn't have the attitudes that, quote-unquote, they should have.
So when were these studies taken?
1920s, 1930s, 1940s, but the most important bit's the 1930s, because even during the Great Depression, people didn't have the attitudes they were supposed to have. And it turned out that Middletown was a real place. It was Muncie, Indiana. And the workers there didn't see their employers as their enemies. They didn't think their employers had different interests to them. So obviously the workers, the guild, were victims of false consciousness.
Absolutely, yes.
And they needed to be helped. But at least these academics were honest, because they honestly reported their findings. They also reported the fact that the Rotarians and the other employers, or what they would call employers' organizations of the Crown, drove out the Ku Klux Klan, which is not what they were expecting, because they were expecting that they would use this racist organization to further their capitalistic objectives, not drive them out of the town.
Why did they drive them out?
But
why did they drive them out, I wonder?
Because they were attacking black people, which the local Rotarians and so forth thought was bad.
Oh, because they're workers. I mean, they're employees. You don't really, you want employees to be fit.
Or neighbours. Yes.
Yes, indeed.
So they had words with them, with big sticks. And the KKK, not being known for their courage, decided to leave. But the whole point of the American left movement, which goes back to books published quite recently, for example, like What's Wrong with Kansas, which was quite famous on the American left only a few years ago, is why do people have these evil attitudes? Sometimes they blame religion. Sometimes they just blame capitalistic propaganda, you know, Fox News, the Koch brothers, whatever. Or Koch brothers, I should say. And they just carry on like that. But it is actually quite important and quite relevant for what you were talking about, because it is directly relates to unemployment. Because the more of these decisions get made, you know, for example, the more unionized the economy might be in key sectors, the more unemployment you get. And the rest of it, too.
So the more unionized, the more unemployment.
Well, take, for example, Texas. Texas has created about half of all the non-government new jobs over the last few years. So if you've got a job over the last few years and you're not working for the government, half of all the people in America who haven't got government jobs, who've got new jobs, got them in Texas.
Wow.
So the
EPA, Texas's population is what, something like a tenth of
Texas has the second biggest population of any state, but it's only about, what, 10-15% of the total population. I don't have
right, and they got 50% of the new jobs. Wow.
Yeah, 50% of the new non-government jobs.
Well, I mean real jobs we're talking about here.
Yeah, and so now the EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency, and other groups have decided to target Texas. It's not what they've said, but it's the effect of the regulations. They've gone in there and said this coal-fired station's got to close, or it's going to increase its spending by 1,000%. Oh, you can do that. Well, let's make it 1,001%. Yeah, you're going to close now, aren't you? And it's doing it to oil refineries. You know, they haven't allowed oil refineries to be built for years and years, but now they're trying to close the old ones. And basically everything they can get their hands on. There was an executive order just the other day to try and gain control of rural areas in line with this bizarre thing called Agenda 21, which we really don't have time to talk with, but if someone wants to look up Agenda 21 on the wonderful internet, they can.
Well, maybe we'll come back to Agenda 21.
How many millions of years do you have? But I mean, the point is that Texas is being targeted for destruction, and it is actually perverse. Now, one of the big arguments is,
but they're still managing to put on jobs.
Are all these things deliberate, or are they just misguided? I mean, for example, someone could genuinely believe that higher wages, more regulations, all pay for itself through higher productivity, green jobs, you know, which were so successful in Spain, which is why they got 21% unemployment, will all be wonderful, and you know, will be sunshine and lollipops for everybody. Now it will rain lemonade, and we'll all, you know, and so on and so forth. They could actually genuinely believe all this. I mean, unless you can get into their souls, you can't prove it one way or the other. So it could
well,
be.
What's your suspicion?
Oh, I think they're guilty as hell, but then I'm a deeply nasty person. I tend to judge people rather harshly. The thing is, could I prove that? And as I'm not Andrew Breitbart or Glenn Beck, I don't have people going around with recording devices in supposedly private meetings, you know, recording them praising Mao and Che Guevara and so on. I have to give them, well, I suppose I can't, I'd have to formally say, no, I can't prove it. They may be all doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. But no, I think they're guilty. The question is, when does the economy collapse? Does it collapse before or after?
Well, getting back to the communist mindset, I mean, my suspicion is they do believe if socialism, communism was done properly, that we would have a wonderful world and a wonderful life.
There's a big distinction between the mainstream progressives and the socialists, because the mainstream progressives, and they ally with the socialists, are not socialists themselves.
They aren't?
No, John Bicklethwaite, of the Economist magazine, would not consider himself a socialist. He'd pass the polygraph test. If you said, John, are you a socialist? He'd say no.
The key question is when you ask him, what's the difference between you and a socialist? That's the...
He believes in the rule of an elite. He believes in internationalism. He wouldn't believe in a formal world government, but he would believe in internationalism. He believes that the elite should guide us in every aspect of our lives. But he doesn't believe that the means of production, distribution, and exchange should all be owned by the state. So he would say no, and he would be honest in saying he's not a socialist. Now, he's quite prepared to ally with socialists, and the reason I say that is the front page of The Economist after January the 20th, 2009, the renewal of America, with Barack Obama sitting on the front. And I can't believe they didn't know by then what Barack Obama was, or what his background was.
Well, maybe they're just like the rest of the MSM, just weren't looking in the right direction.
Very hard to not spot it. I mean, this is a man whose first mentor was Frank Marshall Davis, an active member of the Communist Party. That's when he was a boy. His mother and father, the mother and father of Barack, not the mother and father of Frank Marshall Davis, met at their Russian language class.
Maybe they were interested in Russian.
Yeah, except one was from Kenya and... The parents of Stanley Dunham, she was a very weirdly named little girl, their little red church in Washington State before they moved to Hawaii. It's just completely bizarre. Then, of course, he goes on to Occidental, where there's plenty of testimony that he was a Marxist. He goes on to Columbia, he attends various Marxist conferences, goes to Chicago, hooks up with Belairs, even though he's probably met Belairs in New York. 20 years.
He's
a terrorist. Yeah, his normal defence is, "I didn't kill anybody." Which
that's okay. Okay.
Leave aside Belairs. For 20 years, Barack went to a liberation theology church controlled by the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who's made it perfectly plain and as a matter of public record that he is a supporter of liberation theology. He is a Protestant, not a Catholic, but he uses the term liberation theology, specifically in his case, black liberation theology, because he supports it.
What is liberation theology when it's at home?
Marxism. That's what it is. Okay. That's all it is.
Okay, but it's obviously been repackaged for a reason. I mean,
it's repackaged twice, in fact. Marxism is first repackaged as liberation theology to appeal as Christians, and then it's repackaged again as black liberation theology in order to appeal to black Christians specifically. And it wasn't actually originally done by Jeremiah Wright. He took it from other people.
The point is taken is Barack Obama is a
He has
Marxist.
An enormously strong, clear... Hillary Clinton comes from the mainstream of the progressive tradition, which you can trace back to Richard Ely. And she worked with people such as Saul Alinsky. Saul Alinsky, she was actually offered the deputy position, which she turned down because she wanted to go to Yale Law School. Now, Saul Alinsky may or may not have been a Marxist, very hard to prove. And certainly wanted to, fundamentally transform the United States. But the thing is, you could argue till the cows come home about Hillary. And broadly speaking, the mainstream position is Jonah Goldberg's position in liberal fascism, that she's broadly part of the American progressive tradition, which is an incredibly nasty thing to be, but it's not Marxism. With Barack, the situation is rather different. If Barack is not a Marxist, why does he keep appointing them? Why has he spent his whole life working with them? You know, he must be an incredibly unlucky man. I mean, he's...
Okay. Isn't there a bigger question here? Despite him being in charge for two years now, America is still, broadly speaking, capitalist. I mean,
what could he actually do? What could he actually do that he hasn't already done?
What has he done that, say, Hillary Clinton wouldn't have done?
For example, the Free Press Organization. The Free Press Organization, I think it's not libelous to say they're Marxist, because, after all, Joel Rogers and the other University of Wisconsin academics who run Free Press set it up, created it, are openly Marxist. Now, you get people from the Free Press Organization, then you put them into the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Now, okay, you've done that. You've got your Marxists there. Well, that doesn't help you unless the FCC can actually pass regulations to do stuff like, let's say, have net neutrality on the Internet. Now, the FCC is not supposed to have power over the Internet, but it's trying for a power grab anyway. Now, how does that help you? Well, first of all, lots of little bloggers love you because you package that by saying, why should you be treated worse than the Ford Motor Company?
Hey.
Why should they get better service than you, Joe Blogger? And Joe Blogger says, yeah, right on. I should be treated the same. I should have the same access to the Internet and not have to pay for it and blah, blah, blah. The government will help me. And they will. They're being completely honest. They'll absolutely help you against these evil corporations like who own the cable systems like Comcast. They will help you against these people and forbid these people from discriminating against you and giving more better service to people who pay them more money, like, let's say, the Ford Motor Company. Of course, there's a price here. The price is control. Because when you take the Internet away from these evil, greedy companies like Comcast, and they are greedy, they're in business to make money, and you give it to the FCC or some other organization, which just happens by pure coincidence to contain people from Free Press, guess whose political stuff doesn't get transmitted quite so easily as it used to be?
Exactly.
And guess whose political stuff gets a little bit of a boost? Now, they also, of course, want to do this to things like radio and television. And they were quite happy talking about how radio and television was, oh, it was wrong and evil, that there should be stations.
But I thought radio and television was always already subject to the Fairness Doctrine.
Now, FCC had jurisdiction over radio and television, but the Fairness Doctrine was yanked by Reagan back in the 80s. They do not want to bring the Fairness Doctrine back. That's a big mistake that people make. They've gone beyond that.
Well, why do they want to bring it back?
Because they have new ideas. For example, localism. Now, that sounds cute. You are a radio station. You should discuss local affairs, like the business of the local council. Sounds fair?
Right.
Of course, no one wants you to listen to that crap. So you go bust. And, of course, Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and other people who syndicate their stuff via lots of local radio stations don't get broadcast because you're busy covering the local council's stuff on dog catching.
I see.
There's all sorts of ways that you can break people in the media world without doing something as crude and old-fashioned as the Fairness Doctrine. That's why they won't do it.
I think we should explain what the Fairness Doctrine was. I mean, it was just the idea that...
The idea that when you had someone on, you had to give equal time to someone with the opposite point of view. And it never worked because it never actually counted the presenter.
Mm-hmm.
So what it in fact meant was the presenter was, you know, giving his unbiased view, which is to the left. Then you'd have guests, and there had to be an equal number of guests who were Republicans and Democrats, and the Republicans would be carefully chosen so they were useless, and so on. As someone once said, or as many people once said, if the Fairness Doctrine came back tomorrow, would CBS, ABC, CBS, NBC, and all the rest of them be in court? No. Would Fox? Yes. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, because Fox doesn't do things quite the way they do. It leans the other way that they do. But it must be remembered this is Fox News and Fox Business, not Fox Entertainment, which definitely doesn't lean to the right. Seth MacFarlane and the others, yeah, they're exactly, their cartoon series are very much on the left. This is all quite boring. In Britain, taxation is enormous, government spending is enormous. Could it be worse? Yes, it could be worse. Could it be better? Yes, it could be better. Credit bubble financial system, just like America. European situation. A whole series of credit bubble countries.
So the credit bubble wasn't popped in 2008?
No, certainly not. I mean, what they did was they had a choice. They could have a depression then and there, or major recession, possibly a depression, or they could put everything off by spending huge sums of money. And they put everything off by spending huge sums of money. And doubled the national debt doing it, even as a percentage of GDP. In fact, more than doubled it. And there was a report came out just yesterday in the United States. If you add the... What they'll tell you is that TARP made a profit. What they don't tell you is that the banks paid back the money with other money they were given.
TARP was a scheme where the government took these sort of toxic assets, in other words, assets...
Well, that's what it was called. It was called the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Mm. But as soon as Congress voted for that, which was the second attempt, because the first time they voted it down, they then decided they'd use the money for everything apart from that. Basically, they used the money
randomly. So it's a stimulus package, right?
The stimulus was the second bill. That was $700 billion, and that great conservative John Huntsman, who's now running for president, said it should have been $1 trillion. So TARP and the stimulus are two separate bills. And TARP is the one they'll tell you, they're paying all that money back, and they're not telling you that they're paying that back from money the Federal Reserve is giving them, or from money that they've actually made by lending money to the government and earning profit on the interest.
I mean, the money that the Fed is giving them, that's through the low interest rate business.
Well, it's basically handing them money on virtually zero interest rates, which they then proceed to lend back to the government via the Treasury Department. And then they pay back the Fed, and they pay back
through
the Treasury,
bonds,
and everyone's
happy,
apart from the fact the currency is completely debased and going to hell.
So this is they lend it back through U.S. bonds.
Well, basically, what will happen is that someone who works for Goldman Sachs at the Federal Reserve, used to work for Goldman Sachs, I forgot about our libel laws, will ring up Goldman Sachs and tell them on what day the Federal Reserve is going to sell some bonds or whatever, or treasuries. And then Goldman Sachs will go and buy them and sell them to someone else.
Mm. But essentially, they're borrowing from the Fed at, say, 0.5%, and then they are going to get these bonds
at the Fed doesn't print money. Right? If you ever say the Fed prints money, they laugh at you. What they do is they create it with computer entries, which, of course, is completely different.
Of course. Even cheaper, even.
Yeah, it's totally different. There's no printing press involved. How dare you say we print money? They create money with computer entries and stimulative deposits, and then they hand it out to banks, and it goes into the system, and hey presto. Mm-hmm. And that is the modern financial system, and if you consider it and think about it too long, you go mad. Because that is only a few of the absurdities involved in it. There is a whole series of absurdities, one after the other. What they normally do is change it all into mathematics. Because if you just see a load of mathematical formulae on a blackboard, it just says, it's nothing, it's just squiggles. If you put it into words and start thinking about it, then it really is bad for you.
I had been under the impression that the Fed itself was buying government bonds. Is that not true?
Of course it does. It buys huge sums of them. That's what QE1 and QE2, quantitative easing 1 and quantitative easing 2, were all about. They bought government bonds. They also bought lots of other stuff.
Oh, I see. So QE is the Fed buying bonds, and just low interest rates is Goldman Sachs.
And the stock market goes up because, shall I quote some traders on the stock market, QE1 and QE2 means free money. Mm-hmm. So the stock market goes up, which means they're all prosperous until it stops. So you have a choice. Either you can believe you can create new money forever, in which case you've actually constructed a perpetual motion machine, except it's a perpetual motion machine which speeds up, which, by the way, would destroy the universe, but we'll leave that aside.
Maybe this is how the future is. Every time there's a slight downturn, they'll just print some more money and we'll all be okay.
And makes the capital structure more and more twisted.
Now, when you say this is the idea that, frankly, it becomes almost impossible to engage in long-term projects because you just simply have no idea what you've got and how many bricks there are.
It becomes impossible to engage in almost anything because all the prices you're dealing with are fake. It's like very much like the housing market, where for years you could just wander in and get 100% mortgage, and then someone would actually offer you to give you money on top. Yes, this was called a minus mortgage.
So it was 105% mortgages. This sort of thing. These are the things that Northern Rock were doing. Yeah,
If you've got to the ultimate level of absurdity, which is 100% mortgage, the only way to go is even more absurd and have a 105% or 110%. And if you keep on printing money to support this, you go off into the stratosphere. And it's completely distorted. It means that a rabbit hutch is worth £1 million or something like that. And we saw this in Japan many, many years ago, where at one point the equivalent real estate in size to the size of the Imperial Gardens in Tokyo was supposed to be worth more than the entire state of California.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could either believe that or say, our capital structure is completely bleep, bleep, bleep. And it turned out that our capital structure was indeed completely bleep, bleep, bleep. And unfortunately, we've now copied the Japanese, except it's gone much further. I mean, what we've done, is makes what they did seem like nothing.
I mean, this is in terms of QE and stimulus and that
not
sort of thing.
Not in terms of government deficits and borrowing, because, of course, what the Japanese then did was they, for about 10 years, had stimulus plan after stimulus plan.
I don't think they've stopped. I really don't. I mean, I believe the Japanese debt is, what, up 200%, something like that? 200% of GDP?
Yeah, the government debt as a percentage of GDP is way over 100%. In America, it's only 70%. They basically put concrete upon concrete upon concrete, and some of them are even now applauding the earthquake. They think the earthquake's a good thing, because it will give them a chance to have more public works projects to rebuild everything.
Hmm.
So they've got to the stage where they think an earthquake and a tsunami is a good thing. And if you are a strict believer in Keynesian economics, it is. Of course, none of this thing is actually true. It's all false. It's completely false from beginning to end. And all it does is kick the can down the road and make everything worse. The Americans have a choice. They have the only question in the American context is, do you have the depression now, before the election, or after it? There's no option which says you avoid it. You were asking me something about Japan, weren't you?
No, I was simply asking about the kicking the can. I mean, it's simply when it stops. When does the...
Well, I can only see one argument for doing it. It's the argument that Hayek made in a letter to a gentleman whose name I can't recall, who's very high up in the German Central Bank in the dying days of Weimar. He said, I don't think your policy, Germany, was reducing interest rates in a desperate attempt to stave off the worst of the depression, would actually do any long-term good. However, the political situation at the moment is so bad with the Nazi strength that even if you think it's going to do short-term good at a long-term cost, then to keep the Nazis out, do it. It's about the only time that Hayek ever endorsed the stimulus. But it didn't work and the depression just carried on. But
sorry, I thought there was a gap here. I thought, I mean, the hyperinflation was 1923.
Hyperinflation was
the early 1920s,
by introducing
what, the rent
but they
and
also tried to deal with the depression in various ways. They didn't go around printing money. They physically printed money in the early 20s. What they tried in the early 30s was to reduce the interest rates. But people were so spooked they weren't going to go into that game.
Oh, so it's the early 30s that Hayek was writing his letter, is that right?
He was writing his letter about 1932. He wasn't talking about the hyperinflation of the early 20s. He was talking about the situation they were in. He was saying that any attempt to mitigate the depression by monetary expansion would fail in the long term. It would indeed make things worse. But if there was a short-term effect, I mean, for example, even Glenn Beck, for 3 days, Glenn Beck supported TARP. He supported TARP for 3 days on his radio show. He supported it because he believed, quite falsely, that what the government was doing was giving people time to organize their affairs before everything went to hell, you know, before the banks collapsed and so on. They'd have some
sales
time
of the
to
bigger
prepare.
Fool.
Yeah. Well, no, they you'd, for example, have some time to, I don't know, you can be extreme if you like. He sometimes talks like this, you know, store food or, you know, get your affairs in order as best you can. And then everything goes. When he worked out that their plan was to just try and keep it going forever, which is clearly impossible, then he stopped supporting TARP. And it took 3 days for him to work that out. Because if you're Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase, or any of these people, you don't want the game to ever end. You want the game to carry on forever.
I mean, these guys, I think, have got to be careful. Don't they realise that, you know, people are starting to know who J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs are?
The people on the left are much more ruthless in exposing them than we are. If you, for example, watch RT, Russian television, and you watch the Kaiser Report.
Oh, the Kaiser. Yes, I do watch the Kaiser Report.
Now,
anyway,
Max
yes.
Kaiser is one of Putin's boys. He's not to be trusted.
No.
And a lot of what he says is a direct lie. But there's enough truth in that, in what he says, for him to be very effective. And a lot of the things he says about Goldman Sachs, or J.P. Diamond at J.P. Morgan Chase, or Bank of America, is true. He has a lot of contacts. He was in that world. He knows these people, at least, you know, knows what they do. And what he'll do is he'll talk about banksters and bankster occupation, etc., etc. Now, I repeat, quite a lot of what he says is not true. The banks didn't create the Greek problem. The Greeks created it themselves by their own borrowing for their own welfare state.
Well, he believes in climate change.
But what he'll do is he'll mix in enough truth to make the propaganda deadly. Because what he wants is for people to openly turn on, you know, financiers, bankers, regardless, hunt them down through the streets, whatever. And it's not libel, because you have to listen to his show to hear him saying, oh,
well, I don't think he's ever said that, but he doesn't like them. I mean, he talks about, you know,
oh, and I think he says he wants revolution. He openly uses the R word. Now, if you challenged him, you'd say, well, I'm just using rhetoric. I don't mean it literally. I don't merely want them hung up on the lampposts.
Well, he never actually said, I never heard him use the word lamppost yet.
Exactly, exactly. He leads the horse to water,
yes,
and then says, the horse is drinking, it's nothing to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the left are very good like that. There was a gentleman who used to work for Obama and also for the SEIU, Union, Service yeah. International Employees Union. And he was talking quite openly about organizing hatred of Bank of America and so on, and he was on tape. And the joke was a lot of these banks had actually given money to Obama. So actually they paid for the rope which was going to be put around their necks, to quote Lenin.
Why do they do that? I mean, it's just simply access.
If you read the book Bought and Paid For by Casperino, who's on Fox Business now, but he used to be in the banking game.
What's second name, Catherina?
Gasparino, Italian, with a G.
Oh, Gasparino, right.
But the book is easy to find on the internet. It's simply called Bought and Paid For.
Mm-hmm.
He'll tell you how financial interests on Wall Street allied with Obama going back to as early as 2004.
Wow.
And the thing is, both sides were telling the truth. Obama, like Christopher Dodd, Senator Christopher Dodd, or Barney Frank, Congressman Barney Frank, those were the two chairmen, or became the chairman of the Senate and the House committees. Obama was pro-monetary expansion, pro the affordable housing policy, therefore pro-banking, in that sense, you know, pro-subsidies. So he was telling the truth. He just didn't explain exactly what his long-term objectives were. And the banks were telling the truth when they said they supported him financially in his political campaigns because he was doing all in favour of stuff which would help their shareholders, which was also true. So neither side was lying and neither side was doing anything criminal.
Well, I can't believe they're both going to win. That's the thing. I mean, one of them's going to win out in the end, I assume. I don't see how the bankers can do it. I can see how the Marxists might, but the bankers, it seems to me to be...
This is the problem between short-term and long-term thinking. The bankers, or at least Soros, who's not technically a banker, I mean, technically he's a fund manager for the Quantum Fund, but the Soros wants a new world order and he wants it to be non-Marxist. He's sort of, you know, ruled by experts, and I'm using the Marxists, they're my pawns. The Marxists want something rather different. The bankers are thinking so short-term. They're incredibly wealthy and incredibly intelligent, vastly more intelligent than they and me, but incredibly short-term brains. Well, perhaps if they are thinking long-term, they're thinking, we pile up lots of money, then we run away.
Well, you've got to get your timing absolutely right on those sorts of things, haven't you?
And no one will find us because we'll hide. A bit like that bloke who used to be the head of the organized crime in Massachusetts, who thought, A, no one can touch me because I own the FBI, and my brother is the head of the Senate in Massachusetts. A series based in Rhode Island called Brotherhood was based on this. Then he thought, no one can touch me because no one can find me. He was arrested yesterday.
Oh, right.
But he was on the run for 10 years. Hey, yeah, did well. But he thought he was untouchable, and he wasn't, because the people he owned in the FBI were themselves arrested. And they said, he was an informant of ours. That's why we used to talk to him. So why did you tell him everything we were about to do? Well, we had to tell him a few things, because he told us things too. Don't send us to prison forever.
I see, right. Okay, so it was a two-way relationship he'd got into.
Yeah, he
right.
was technically an informant, but actually he was using them. Of course, he paid them, which, of course, is why they're in jail now. But, I mean, if you're dealing with the bankers, they're thinking in somewhat honest terms of that, because nothing they're doing is illegal. I must stress that. It is not illegal. It's just a completely whacked-out, insane system, and they're hoping to profit from it. Some of them probably hoping for this wonderful new world order of Soros and Co. and the Bilderbergers and all these other fantasies. And some of them are just hoping that everything will just carry on as it always has, not realizing that they're like a junkie. Each time you have to have a bigger dose.
Presumably there was a time when these banks actually did something useful. I seem to remember J.P. Morgan
they
himself.
They still do. It's just that each time you get a fix, I mean, a junkie could have a perfectly legitimate job. It's a myth that all junkies, you know, lie in corners. A lot of junkies have perfectly straight jobs. The trouble is they have to keep stepping up the dose to have the same effect. An alcoholic is the same.
And it's the same with credit.
And it's the same with credit. You have to keep on jacking up the dose. And you end up doing less and less.
Because, I
take, for example, an alcoholic employee in a newspaper. He's an alcoholic. Mm. You send him to cover a fire. He may do a brilliant job. He may write an absolutely wonderful piece of journalism on that fire, which none of your other staff could have done as well as he did. But you don't want him on the city desk, because he may be whacked out of his brain and just get something wrong at a key moment. And that's the problem. The banks still do useful things, but they do less and less useful things and more crap things, because they get more and more addicted to credit. They're basically junkies, all of them, including the Republican Bank, which is Wells Fargo, which is known as the Republican Bank because it's the only major bank where the top brass are Republicans. They are just as addicted to credit money as the rest.
When did they get this this addiction? I mean, was it sort of after I-71?
No one wakes up in the morning and says, I'm going to be a junkie today. I think it's really cool.
No.
Hey, look, before 1913, they covered about one-third of their liabilities in hard cash.
And so that's a reserve ratio of that was 1 to 3.
Yeah, about 1 to 3.
Right, okay.
That was considered really wild and wacky in the days of J.P. Morgan. Yeah.
And nowadays it's near 1 in 20.
Well, that's about 2%, is it?
Is it 2%? I mean, I think it's, yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
But I mean, it didn't go from there to there in one jump.
No.
You have the First World War. You have the credit bubble of the 1920s. You've got the 30s. You've got relative sanity in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It starts getting a little bit weird in the 60s. It gets a lot more weird in the 70s. And, for example, Citibank has been on the verge of collapse at least 3 times. It's been saved several times before the recent one. That's one of the biggies.
And so you get used to this sort of thing.
Pardon?
And you get used to this. You always think you're going to get bailed out.
They do get used to it in a really horrible way. They get bigger and bigger and more addicted to credit bubbles. And the credit bubbles get bigger and bigger as well. And so in the end, you don't have a choice between a recession and another hack of credit or another hit. You have a choice between a depression and another whack of credit. You know, 1981...
Well, presumably, eventually, the option of credit disappears.
1981, Alan Greenspan... Sorry, not Alan, he wasn't around. Paul Volcker cut off the credit.
Uh-huh.
Partly for political reasons. He wanted to embarrass Reagan.
Now he was chairman of the Fed at the time, and he interest rates
and he cut off the credit, and you had this steep recession, 1981, 1982. Really steep.
Yeah.
Even Milton Friedman says, this is too tough. But actually, you know, the economy survived, the economy recovered. But do you know we haven't had a real one of those since then?
Well, there was the late 80s, early 90s.
There was a 92 thing, but even that, when Greenspan took over from Volcker, the credit bubble has been almost perpetual, and each time it gets worse. There was indeed that big thing that brought down George Bush, George Bush Sr.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, and even that didn't clear out the malinvestments, it wasn't big enough. You haven't had a real clear out of the malinvestment since the early 80s.
Sorry, Paul. I'm a bit confused about this because now I remember the recession of 89, 92, as I would describe it. And I do remember there was certainly a credit boom before that. That was the 87 crash.
Britain,
I mean, the housing, there was a huge bubble in housing.
Both had a massive credit boom in the 80s because of Nigel Lawson in this country, or rather the Bank of England and Nigel Lawson in this country. And it wasn't his tax policy, it was his monetary policy.
Well, he was trying to tackle the exchange rate, wasn't he?
And America too. And there was indeed a recession, 89, 92.
How do we know it didn't clear out the malinvestments? That's my...
It cleared out some of them, but not all. And it wasn't as dramatic as the one of before. But the thing is, even after that, Greenspan then just rebuilt them all.
Well, I mean, he did it with...
The dot-com bubble was him, the housing... But each time
he
had
a sort of went off with the long-term capital management, wasn't that...
Do you actually know what caused, in America, that one?
Well, long-term capital management?
It was not that. That wasn't relevant. That was a small thing compared to this. There was a credit bubble early on in Greenspan's career. It was a mild one, and it led to the panic of 1987, which everyone forgets, but there was one.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big panic in 1987.
Well, immediately after the crash,
could have had a recession then, but Greenspan said, no, we're not going to have a recession. And he basically poured money into the system. And that's why you got that boom and bust.
Oh.
And it was actually his reaction to the panic of 87. But even after that, he did it again and again and again throughout the 90s and throughout the early 2000s. And each time he had a plausible excuse. You've already named one, long-term capital management, which is all those Nobel Prize-winning arseholes. Mexico was another one. In the old days, I'm so old, I can remember when you didn't have to be an arsehole to get a Nobel Prize. These days, you basically have to be one. You have to be like Stiglitz or Krugman. Or you have to be like Obama and get the Nobel Peace Prize, and you haven't done anything.
I better get that one.
that was actually not the most absurd one. The most absurd Nobel Peace Prize was 1993, which was given to a Guatemalan novelist, because everyone assumed that her book was true. I don't think she even formally said it was. It had stuff like her brother being burned alive in it and stuff. And she was named a Peace Prize for this.
Right, but getting back to Greenspan, his career, certainly as chairman of the Fed, was just bubble after bubble.
He's basically bubble after bubble after bubble. Everyone keeps talking about how he was a follower of Ayn Rand. They don't mention that she put her dinner in his face.
I'd never heard that one. I mean, I understand is Greenspan was an acolyte of Ayn Rand in the 60s.
And has
written, I mean, you find these things occasionally on the internet. There is a paper by him talking about the need for a gold standard and what have you.
Yeah, but the thing is, Ayn Rand is often attacked for falling out with people on personal grounds. And that may or may not be true. I don't know. I never knew her. She died in 1982. But I'm telling you, it was nothing to do with personal grounds in the case of Alan Greenspan, because Alan Greenspan never said boo to a goose. He's not some sort of person who you'd fall out with on a personal level. She fell out with him because he sold out. It was really crude. You know, someone like Max Keiser would be able to explain it better than me. He sold out to the system, to the credit bubble system. And he sold out in a big, big way. And he's arguably the worst Federal Reserve chairman there's been. I mean, because the one who created the 1920s was not actually Federal Reserve Board chairman. He was chairman of the New York Bank.
This is Benjamin Strong we're talking about.
This is Ben Strong, who Milton Friedman falsely thinks is wonderful, or falsely thought was wonderful. But he was never actually technically chairman of the Federal Reserve. But, you know, Greenspan was, without doubt, the worst chairman of the Federal Reserve there has been before Ben Bernanke. I mean, no one is as bad as Ben, but, you know. But Ben believes that he's saving the universe. He believes that without him, the universe will collapse.
And he's shocked that things aren't going as he thinks.
Yeah, but the horrible thing is that Ben is actually right in a way, because things have got to such a point. You were talking about 89, 92 and how bad things were. And they were. I don't disagree with you.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be vastly worse now.
Yes.
Because the credit bubble is vastly bigger. The banks would go down like ninepins.
Even after 2008 and even after the sort of recapitalisation, things like that,
they just rebuilt their debts again. I mean, admittedly.
I thought this whole thing, sorry, Paul. Are we sure they've rebuilt their debts? Because my understanding was everyone's complaining about the banks not lending. So.
Well, that's one sensible thing they have done. The one sensible thing they've done is they don't believe their own bullshit about recovery. They obviously don't believe there's going to be one. And they're right. But their money has to go somewhere. So where it's gone is government debt. But that's not just federal government debt. You know, that's things like Greek debt or state debt. Or, you know, like California, or municipal government debt, like Chicago.
Well, that's crazy. The money had to
go somewhere, didn't it? And it couldn't go into the private economy, so they put it, lots and lots of it, almost said all of it, it's not true. They put lots and lots of it in government debt, because they have to pay, even with the ludicrous amounts they pay savers, they have to pay them something. And they have to, you know, satisfy stockholders. And the government was the best game in town.
Mm.
And it's not just the American federal government. Where, you know, the federal government selling its debt to the Federal Reserve Board. But, you know, but it's people who couldn't really do that so easily. Like the state of California. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's gone into really, really unproductive things. The only way, look, basic economics, the only way you can make money as a usurer, as a moneylender, in the long term, is to find people who've got good ideas and are going to produce new stuff. You know, in a way, that's what they thought they were doing with .com.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't, but they thought they were.
Well, in some cases,
and in a few cases, they actually were doing that.
Yeah.
Amazon is an obvious case.
Yeah.
So that's how you make money as a user. You don't make money giving money to people who just spend it. You know, that's the sort of Hogarth's Rakes Progress view of the moneylender. Ah, the moneylender is evil. He gives money to someone who spends it on whores and booze. How does that benefit the moneylender? Because the person doesn't have any money at the end of that to pay him back with.
Yeah.
And if you go around spending just on consumption, if you're just lending out to people who are just consuming and not producing anything, that can't work. So what, as a moneylender, you do is you say, well, partly we're borrowing money, we're lending money for consumption, but only to people who are in work who can then pay us back.
Mm.
You know, they borrow money to have their trip to Vegas or whatever, and then the next 5 years or whatever, putting their nose to the grindstone, they pay us back for their mad folly. But you can't do that with everybody. A lot of your money has to be for productive business investment, to produce goods and services that people want to buy because they're good. It can't be in government bonds to fund trade union pension schemes. You know, that just doesn't work. I mean, in some areas of the United States, the actual percentage of the income that people were paying into their pension schemes in many lines of government work was zero. You know, literally zero.
Mm.
That obviously was not going to last. So how was it financed at all? Well, because states and localities got round those provisions in their constitutions that said they had to have balanced budgets. Because what they did was they financed their capital spending by issuing bonds, which the banks bought. And then the banks could say, you're a liar. We've never lent any money to people to waste on current spending. We've never done it. We've just bought their bonds for their road projects and their hospitals and their schools and all the rest of it, which they've issued bonds for.
Okay, yeah.
And of course the states and localities use their other monies to pay back, put the wages and the pensions and all the rest of the stuff. But do you see the fallacy?
No, I don't.
There was no money to pay back the bonds for the schools,
I see.
The roads.
Yes.
So
right,
they spent all the money on the pensions and the salaries and on the promises of bigger ones.
We've got two things going on. One is that an awful lot of government institutions are effectively bust and can't pay off their liabilities.
I was looking through the figures the other day and they were saying it's a lie that every state is insolvent if you look at its long-term. If you look at its long-term financial liabilities, this is a lie. And I looked at it more closely, and it came out that North Dakota was solvent. It could meet all its pension claims and all its welfare claims as far as they could work out. So, yeah, it was a lie. It's not true that all states are insolvent. But hang on. If most states are it's just as bad. The federal government is certainly insolvent. You know, if it was a private organisation, most of the people connected with it would be in prison. It's completely insolvent. Forget its official national debt. Its unfunded liabilities go into the trillions. Trillion upon trillion. And people who deal in treasury bonds, I don't know what they're doing. I mean, presumably they're expecting the government just to print money for it.
Well, we say that when we talk about unfunded liabilities. We're normally talking about pensions. Sorry, Paul. Just a minute. What the hell was that? We're normally talking about pensions, aren't we? When we're talking
pensions,
about
pensions, Medicare, Medicaid.
I mean, if government wants to, it can up pension age, the age where you can get a pension, pretty much with a one-line piece of legislation. I mean, that is doable if they really want to.
I'm not sure anything is doable. I used to be like you up until quite recently. New York 26 really shook me. This was the congressional by-election due to a Republican who showed his chest in a photograph. It was all ridiculous. But anyway, the election was in a safe Republican district. Paul Ryan had produced a plan on Medicare, which doesn't change it at all for anyone over 55.
This is the Ryan plan that people talk about.
Yeah, it changes it in very minor respects for people under 55, you know, that have 10 years to prepare. Then it was swept away. They swept it away. The voters swept it down.
Oh, so the Republicans lost a safe seat?
They, yeah. And the message went out. If you do entitlement reform, the voters will crucify you. Now, admittedly, there was a tidal wave of lies. You know, the adverts had someone dressed up as Paul Ryan,
Paul,
pushing an old woman off a cliff.
I'm sorry. I'd love to go on, but I'm going to have to stop you there because we've gone over an hour.
Okay, God bless.